Grace. 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 Grace.
So now we're picking up tonight in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, and this is the scriptural account of essentially the life of Solomon, what fills in the blanks between the bookends of his coming into power in Israel and the establishment of the tabernacle, the building of the tabernacle and his own palace. And when he passes away, this is what this whole session is about. So again, in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, starting in verse 1, says, at the end of 20 years, during which Solomon had built the Lord's temple and his own palace, Solomon having rebuilt the city's harem gave him, and having settled the Israelites there, Solomon went to Hamath Zobah and seized it. He built Tadmor in the wilderness, along with all the storage cities that he had built in Hamath. He built upper Beth Horon and lower Beth Horon, fortified cities with walls, gates, and bars. Baalath, all the storage cities that belonged to Solomon, all the chariot cities, the cavalry cities, and everything Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, Lebanon, and everywhere else in the land of his dominion. As for all the peoples who remained of the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, there were none who were not of Israel. Their descendants who remained in the land after them, those whom the Israelites had not completely destroyed, Solomon imposed forced labor on them. It is this way to this day. Now, let me go ahead and stop here. I want you to keep in mind, a few chapters ago, we already ran across that. We knew that he had forced labor that was retained from these same people. So this is the first time it's been brought up. It's just being brought up again here. And that's important because we will run into some stuff as far as numbering in a little bit here that will is important to look at. So, but I want you to remember that this has been addressed before already. In fact, you guys, one or two of you had a question about it. So you remember all the artisans that had been sent out to quarry the stones for the tabernacle and all that? All of those were foreigners that did the work. When it came to do with actually putting the temple together, that was largely Israel. But the people that did the hard labor, that was the foreigners who were still living in the land that they did not completely destroy when they occupied the promised land. So verse 9 says, but Solomon did not consign the Israelites to be slaves for his work. They were soldiers, commanders of his captains, and commanders of chariots and his cavalry. These were Solomon's deputies. 250 who ruled over the people, Solomon brought the daughter of Pharaoh from the city of David to the house he built for her, for he said, my wife must not live in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places to which the ark of the Lord has come are holy. So we wanted to separate it. At that time, Solomon offered burnt offerings to the Lord on the Lord's altar he had made in front of the vestibule, following the daily requirement for the offerings according to the commandment of Moses for the Sabbath, the new moons, and the three annual appointed feasts, which were the Festival of Unleavened Bread, the Festival of Weeks, and the Festival of Booths. Verse 14, according to the ordinance of his father, he appointed the divisions of the priests over their service, of the Levites over their responsibilities to offer praise and to minister before the priests following the daily requirements, and of the gatekeepers by their divisions with respect to each gate, for this had been the commandment of David, the man of God. They did not turn aside from the king's command regarding the priests and the Levites concerning any matter or concerning the treasuries. All of Solomon's work was carried out from the day the foundation was laid for the Lord's temple until it was finished. So the Lord's temple was completed. At that time, Solomon went to Ezon-Geber and to Eloth on the seashore of in the land of Edom. Now, if you remember, the Edomites were directly related to the Israelites. They were part of blood from them. They were Esau's descendants. So through his servants, Haram sent him ships with crews of experienced seamen, they went with Solomon's servants to Ophir, took from there 17 tons of gold, and delivered it to King Solomon. Now, if you remember, the King Hiram was the friend of Solomon's father, David, and that friendship continued on past David onto Solomon as well. Hiram considered Solomon to be as worthy of friendship as his father David was. Now, let's go ahead and read the same account in 1 Kings chapter 9, starting in verse 10. And we're going to notice a few apparent discrepancies, and when we do, we'll address them. Okay, 1 Kings chapter 9, starting in verse 10. All right. It says, at the end of 20 years, during which Solomon had built the two houses, the Lord's temple and the royal palace, Hiram, king of Tyre, having supplied him with cedar and cypress trees and gold for his every wish, King Solomon gave Hiram 20 towns in the land of Galilee. So Hiram went out from Tyre to look over the towns that Solomon had given him, but he was not pleased with them. So he said, what are these towns you've given to me, my brother? So he called them Land of Cabal, which means binding, and they are still called this today. I think that more than likely this was possibly a bit of a jest. He gave it to him for whatever purpose, but then when King Hiram was not particularly pleased with the cities he got, Solomon said, well, it's a binding deal, you're stuck with them. So he was called the Land of Cabal, or Kabul, which means binding. Verse 14 says, now Hiram had sent the king 9,000 pounds of gold. This is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon had imposed to build the Lord's temple in his own palace, the supporting terraces, the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazar, Megiddo, and Gezer. Verse 16, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had attacked and captured Gezer. He then burned it down, killed the Canaanites who lived in the city, and gave it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. Then Solomon rebuilt Gezer, Lower Beth Horan, Bethal, Tamar in the wilderness of Judah, all the storage cities that belonged to Solomon, the chariot cities, the cavalry cities, and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, Lebanon, and anywhere else in the land of his dominion. As for all the people who remained of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites who were not of Israel, their descendants who remained in the land after them, those who the Israelites were unable to annihilate, Solomon imposed forced labor on them. It is this way until today. But Solomon did not consign the Israelites to slavery. They were soldiers, his servants, his commanders, his captains, and commanders of chariots, and his cavalry. These were the deputies who were over Solomon's work, 550 who ruled over the people during doing the work. Pharaoh's daughter moved from the city of David to the house that Solomon built for her. He then built the terraces. Three times a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and fellowship offerings on the altar he had built for the Lord, and he burnt incense with them in the Lord's presence. So he completed the temple. King Solomon put together a fleet of ships at Ezon-Geber, which is near Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. With the fleet, Hiram sent his servants, experienced seamen, along with Solomon's servants. They went to Ophir and acquired gold from there, 16 tons, and delivered it to Solomon. Now, let's deal with the apparent disagreement between these two texts. A helpful concept to remember when you're dealing with an alleged discrepancy is the idea that a simple difference is not necessarily a contradiction. And you'll see that in just a moment. Just because two texts differ in the way they relate the facts does not necessarily mean that there exists no possible reconciliation of the text. So let's look at the first example, and that is the number of workers. If you remember what we just read in 1 Kings 9, verse 23, it says, these were the deputies who were over Solomon's work, 550 who ruled over the people doing the work. 2 Chronicles 8:10 says, these were King Solomon's deputies, 250 who ruled over the people. Now, that's a 300-person difference. the profoundly respected Old Testament commentators, Keel and Delch, offer a rather clear and straightforward solution, one that I actually kind of considered, but they did the math on it, and so I won't try to improve on it. I might mention that this solution takes advantage of something that I've been stressing in here regarding properly studying God's Word since we started this track through the Bible. Kalen Deletz simply take a book-wide view of all that has been said regarding this labor force in Israel, and when they did, the problem corrected itself. It wasn't a necessary, you don't even really have to correct it, it fixes itself. The difficulty is if you just take an isolated verse and say, aha, look, I found a problem. Well, you know, wait a minute, back up. Look at the entire landscape of everything that's been said throughout the book, related material, and see if the problem doesn't clear itself up. And about, I would say, probably 95 to 97% of the times, it becomes very obvious what the misstep was, and it's not a big deal. Other times, it gets a little bit more sticky than that. This was not a difficult one at all. You may remember, as I brought up when we read those numbers, that earlier in our comparative study between 2 Chronicles and 1 Kings, there was another apparent discrepancy of precisely 300 people as well. It was found in 1 Kings 5:16 and 2 Chronicles 2:2. When an account of the entire labor force of porters, stonecutters, and such, they recorded the same number, same difference in number. In 1 Kings, it had 3,000 people. In 2 Chronicles, it had, 3,300 people. And in 2 Chronicles, it had 3,600 people. That's a 300-person difference. When the subdivision of those workers are being accounted for, 1 Kings has 550, while 2 Chronicles has 250. That's the same 300 difference in both accounts, only they're flip-flopped. To make it real clear, in 1 Kings, the first account that gave an account of all the workers who'd been sent out to the quarry to do the mining and all that and the stone cutting and all that, it recorded 3,300. That was a lesser number. In Chronicles, it was 3,600. Now, when you look at these, Kings has the higher number of 550, while 2 Chronicles has 250. So it's flip-flopped. In 1 Kings earlier, they had 300 less than 2 Chronicles. Later on, when we read the second account here, what's talking about a subdivision of that bigger number, it's 2 Chronicles that has the smaller number. But the difference is still the same, 300. That automatically should set up warning signs and say, hey, wait a second, here's the answer. If this was simply an error in copying or something similar, the numbers would have rectified themselves in this later account. The chances of recording the same thing the wrong way twice is almost unheard of. And even if that had happened, it would have remained with the same account of 300 being more or less in the exact same place. In other words, Kings would have continued to be the lower number. But here they're flip-flopped. So this is not an accounting problem. This is not a translation problem. This is not a copying problem. In fact, the fact that the numbers are flip-flopped suggests the solutions. So what's the reason for this difference? Well, in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 23, it mentions 550 chief officers of Solomon. If these are added to the number of stonecutters and such that are listed in 1 Kings chapter 5, that means four chapters earlier in the same book, that would raise the total number of supervisors to 3,850. In like manner, if you go to 2 Chronicles 8:10, which mentions 250 chief officers of Solomon, and if these are added to the number of stonecutters and such mentioned in 2 Chronicles 2:18 of 3,600, we arrive at the exact same number of 3,850. So they both account for the exact same number of people. So why were they recorded differently? Well, the difference does not lie with the numbers themselves, but rather the two authors simply classify the officers according to different standards. One might have, and we don't know for sure what the division was, but it kind of suggests itself by the text. One might have been dividing the supervisors according to their nationality, which is very likely what Chronicles was doing. And it makes sense because Chronicles is the only one that mentions the workers as being from among the foreigners. And so nationality would have been on his mind, obviously. Kings doesn't mention where they came from. And so nationality was not on his mind, almost certainly. The account in Kings, therefore, may have been recording the number by their authority, making use of a different Hebrew word, rada. When it says talk about dominion over or deputies over, it was a totally different word that was used in Chronicles. So if you remember, when we covered these passages a couple weeks ago, one of you guys asked the question about the use of foreign workers. Why would you use foreign workers for this and so on? And we noticed at the time that it was only in 2 Chronicles that there was a mention of the nationality of the stonecutters. Kings didn't bring it up. So we see that any hint of contradiction can be cleared up usually pretty easily. And it is once again evident that a simple difference is not necessarily a contradiction. You have to take a global picture of the entire text, do the comparison, and when you do, a lot of times the problem kind of rectifies itself. There's a second problem, though, and that's much later, a little bit later in the text, and that is 1 Kings has it recorded that when they went with the seamen that were sent to Solomon from King Hiram to Ophir to go get gold, 1 Kings it recorded that they brought back 17 tons. In 2 Chronicles, it records 16 tons. That's literally a one-ton difference. This, too, is, believe it or not terribly difficult to account for. And any of at least four possible ways, though which one is true, I can't, say for certain. 16 and 17, which is our measurement for, because we're measuring it in tons. As you can imagine, in ancient Hebrew, they didn't have the unit of a ton or pounds or ounces. They used different measurements. So 16 and 17 are nice little numbers to work with. The same measurement in Hebrew would have appeared very different. In Hebrew, they had, and if you read in the actual text, it talks about talents of gold, which was a measurement of weight. In early Israel, they had adopted the Babylonian measurement of weight for a talent, and that was 66 pounds, 9 ounces. And that was the measurement Israel adopted in the early days, and which would account for 1 Kings. Later in Israel's history, they revised their calculation of a talent for something that they would use just as Hebrews, which may have been the talent conversion used in 2 Chronicles, which would have yielded a slightly different number. Still later in Israel's history was the introduction of what was called the heavy common talent, which was 129 pounds, 14 ounces. That's a big difference. It's almost double the typical Babylonian measurement. So we have three different measurements here. I think you can see the difficulty. This may simply be a matter of translation rather than actual copying error. However, let me press this point home a little further. The measurement used in 2 Chronicles was very likely a talent being measured at 75 pounds, 4 ounces. I'm not asking you to remember this. I'm just throwing it out there as a letting you know that is the measurement. 75 pounds, 4 ounces. Much earlier in Israel's history, it would have been 66 pounds, 9 ounces. So you start adding up to terms of tons, you're going to find a difference in the number of talents. It is said in the one of 1 Kings that it was 420 talents. In the 2 Chronicles, it was 430 talents. When we do the math, that would actually make the weight in 1 Kings 15.8. It's actually much longer than that, but just to keep it in your head, you might want to jot it down on a piece of paper so you can see with your eyes. 1 Kings, the measurement would have been 15.8 tons rather than 16. So it wasn't even a precise measurement anyway. And in 2 Chronicles, it would have actually been 16.2 tons. Okay? So in Kings, it would have been 15.8. In 2 Chronicles, it would have been 16.2. So when we look at the actual difference, there's only 0.377 of a ton. The point being that we know that for sure the biblical translators rounded up in both cases, making the apparent difference even larger than it actually was. Okay, let me illustrate for you, because I think you follow enough math to understand that. If typical mathematical rules had been followed, they would have both recorded 16 tons, not 16 and 17, because 15.8 would be rounded up to 16. And the 16.2 would have been rounded down to 16. They both would have been 16. And we would have not had this discussion. But instead, they rounded both of them up. God only knows why. To add to this is the possibility that such rounding up or down may have already taken place in the original writings. One thing that we know for certain is that Israel, as I've told you before many, many times, the Hebrew mind and the Eastern mind doesn't think like the Western mind. You and I, we measure things down to the last ounce. They didn't. That was not their way. They gave generalizations. Now, when it came down to purchases, they had solid weights. Don't make any mistake by that. Like, I mean, when they were traveling in the wilderness, remember, they had the weight of the shekel that was based upon silver, and it was the standard measurement of the temple. So you remember, there was a standardized unit back then, even still, when it came to do with purchasing and stuff. But when you're talking about quarrying stone and quarrying gold and stuff like that, they would give a general measurement because this wasn't being used for a transaction. It was just a matter of just trying to give an account of approximately how much gold did we bring back from this quarry. So you have to think like an Israelite. So a difference between 16.2 and 15.8, who cares? This was a marginal difference. It literally wasn't a full ton. It was a fraction of a ton. But from you and I's perspective, it shows up as a discrepancy and therefore a problem. So that having been said, you know, and it may, you know, no one's saying that maybe it could not have been a simple copying error. It's just very, very unlikely. And the reason why is because we have so many copies of the original texts. I mean, to the tune of thousands. It would be near to impossible for every one of them to have had the exact same copying error. That's just not even feasible. And they all say the same thing. So this clearly wasn't a copying problem. Almost, it's more likely that pigs flew at some point in history than that this was a copying error. But, you know, we can't completely categorically eliminate that. Another possibility is that 1 Kings records the amount of gold which actually made it to the king's treasury. Since there was a labor force involved, it is possible that out of the 17 tons, portion of that was dispersed among the workers as pay for their labor. And 2 Chronicles did not make the distinction between the two. That's also possible. Finally, you have the issue of generalizations. Like I said, you know, they really were not always, you know, measuring things down to the last dot, jot, and tittle. I mean, you could see that earlier when at the beginning of Solomon's reign, it talked about how gold increased and, you know, they had this much gold, had this much silver. But then when it came down to iron, it said they had so much iron in the land, they didn't even bother counting it because it would have just taken too much time. Well, then that doesn't show that they were straining at a gnat when it comes down to have to know exact figures. You know what I mean? So the general principle would have been that, you know, this was probably a rough estimate. And in one account, it was rounded up. The other was rounded down. Or it's very possible also this was a difference in measurement. If you remember back when we were looking at the tabernacle, the measurement of a cubit when they were in the tabernacle was different than it was when they moved into the promised land, which was hundreds and hundreds of years later. Back when they were started in the wilderness, they were using the cubit that they were familiar with, which was the Egyptian cubit. They had been building things with the Egyptian cubit for years. But throughout their track in the wilderness, and when they settled in the promised land, history shows us that the cubit measurement changed. And so, you know, that may be the case here as well. So one way or the other, it's not a huge discrepancy, but I thought I'd address it because chances are more than one of you picked up on it. So now we're going to go back to 1 Kings chapter 10, starting in verse 1. And this is the section we're going to be dealing with Solomon's wisdom and wealth. Solomon's wisdom and wealth. 1 Kings chapter 10, starting in verse 1, says, "The queen of Sheba heard about Solomon's fame connected with the name of the Lord and came to test him with difficult questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, I guess, entourage is what you and I would probably say, with camels bearing spices and gold in great abundance and special stone, precious stones. She came to Solomon and spoke to him about everything that was on her mind. So Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too difficult for the king to explain to her. When the queen of Sheba observed all of Solomon's wisdom, the palace he had built, the food at his table, his servants' residence, his attendants' service and their attire, his cupbearers and the burnt offerings he offered the Lord's at the Lord's temple, it took her breath away. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your words and about your wisdom is true, but I didn't believe the reports until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, I was not even told the half of it. Your wisdom and prosperity far exceed the report I heard. How happy are your men? How happy are these servants of yours who always stand in your presence, hearing your wisdom? May the Lord your God be praised. He delighted in you and put you on the throne of Israel because the Lord's eternal love for Israel. He's made you king to carry out justice and righteousness." Then she gave the king 4.5 tons of gold, a great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again did such a quantity of spices arrive as those the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. In addition, Hiram's fleet that carried gold from Ophir brought from Ophir a large quantity of almug, I guess is how you would say it, wood and precious stones. The king made the almug wood into steps for the Lord's temple and the king's palace, and into harps and lyres for the singers. Never before had such almug wood come, and the like has not been seen again since this very seen it again even to this very day. King Solomon gave the queen, King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba her every desire, whatever she asked, besides what he had given her out of his royal bounty. Then she, among with her servants, returned to their own country. The weight of gold that came to Solomon annually was 25 tons, besides what came from merchants, traders, merchandise, and all the Arabian kings and governors of the land. King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 15 pounds of gold went into each shield. He made 300 small shields of hammered gold. About 4 pounds of gold went into each one of those. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. The king also made a large ivory throne and overlaid it with fine gold. The throne had 6 steps, and there was a rounded top at the back of the throne, armrest on either side of the seat, and 2 lions standing beside the armrests. 12 lions were standing there on the steps, one at each end. Nothing like it had ever been made in any other kingdom. All of King Solomon's drinking cups were of gold, and all the utensils of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. There was no silver, since it was considered as nothing in Solomon's time. For the king had ships of Tarshish at sea with Hiram's fleet, and once every 3 years the ships of Tarshish would arrive bearing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the world in riches and in wisdom. The whole world wanted an audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom that God had put in his heart. Every man would bring his annual tribute, items of silver and gold, clothing, weapons, spices, and horses and mules. Solomon accumulated 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen and stationed them in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and he made cedar as abundant as sycamore in the Judean foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and Ku. The king's traders brought them from Ku at the going price. A chariot was imported from Egypt for 15 pounds of silver and a horse for about 4 pounds of silver. In the same way, they exported them all to all the kings of the Hittites and all the kings of Aram and their agents. That was just right there an example of buying power. The king was able to buy it at the common price, but he was able to buy lots of it and then resell it to people who could not probably could not have afforded the import and export. Now let's look at the same account in 2 Chronicles chapter 9. 2 Chronicles chapter 9, starting in verse 1. It says, "The queen of Sheba heard of Solomon's fame. So she came to test Solomon with difficult questions at Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels bearing spices, gold in abundance, and precious stones. She came to Solomon and spoke with him about everything that was on her mind. So Solomon answered all of her questions. Nothing was too difficult for Solomon to explain to her. When the queen of Sheba observed Solomon's wisdom, the palace he had built, the food at his table, the servants' residence, his attendant service and their attire, his cupbearers and their attire, and the burnt offerings he offered to the Lord's temple, it took her breath away. She said to the king, 'The report I heard in my own country about your words and about your wisdom is true. But I didn't believe their reports until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, I wasn't even told the half of your great wisdom. You far exceed the report that I heard about you. How happy are your men? How happy are these servants of yours? Who stand always in your presence, hearing your wisdom? May the Lord your God be praised. He delighted in you and put you on his throne as king for the Lord your God. Because your God loved Israel enough to establish them forever, he has set you over them as king to carry out justice and righteousness.' Then she gave the king 4.5 tons of gold, a great quantity of spices and precious stones. There never were such spices as those the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. In addition, Hiram's servants and Solomon's servants who brought gold from Ophir also brought algum wood and precious stones. The king made the algum wood into walkways for the Lord's temple and for the king's palace and into harps and lyres for the singers. Never before had anything like them been seen in the land of Judah. King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba her every desire, whatever she asked, far more than she had brought to the king. Then she, along with her servants, returned to her own country. The weight of gold that came to Solomon annually was 25 tons, besides what was brought in by the merchants and traders. All the Arabian kings and governors of the land also brought gold and silver to Solomon. King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 15 pounds of hammered gold went into each one of them. He made 300 small shields of hammered gold. About 8 pounds of gold went into each shield. There again, you have the same measurement issue. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. The king also made a large ivory throne and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had 6 steps. There was a footstool covered in gold for the throne, armrests on either side of the seat, 2 lions standing beside the armrest, and 12 lions were standing there on the 6 steps, one at each end. Nothing like it had ever been made in any other kingdom. All of King Solomon's drinking cups were of gold, and all the utensils of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. There was no silver, since it was considered a worthless thing in Solomon's time, for the king's ships kept going to Tarshish and Hiram's servants, and once every 3 years, the ships of Tarshish would arrive bearing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the world in riches and in wisdom. All the kings of the world wanted an audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put into his heart. Each of them would bring his own gifts, items of silver and gold, clothing, weapons, spices, and horses and mules as an annual tribute. Solomon had 4,000 stalls of horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen. He ruled over all the kings from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines and as far as the border of Egypt. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and he made cedar as abundant as sycamore in the Judean foothills. They were bringing horses for Solomon from Egypt and from all the countries. Now we're going to go ahead and read the last part that we're going to probably, the last few parts we're going to read tonight, going back to 1 Kings, starting at chapter 11. And let me also suggest something to you regarding another thing that had occurred to me regarding a difference in this ladder measurement for the smaller shields. In Kings, things were written during the time that they had occurred. Second Chronicles was written from a perspective of history. And so from the time that they were written in First Kings, they could have increased. And the only one that would have had knowledge of the number of that increase or the difference in pounds would have been the latter account of Second Chronicles. So there's also another possibility for the difference in numbers. So in 1 Kings chapter 11, starting in verse 1, says King Solomon, this is where these passages right here deal with Solomon's heart as it began to turn away from the Lord. Verse 1 says, King Solomon loved many foreign women in addition to Pharaoh's daughter, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonite, and Hittite women from the nations that the Lord had told the Israelites about not to intermarry with them. And they must not intermarry with you, because they will turn you away from me to their gods. This was the warning God had given Israel. Solomon was so deeply attached to these women and loved them. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines, and they turned his heart away from the Lord. When Solomon was old, his wives seduced him to following other gods. His heart was not completely with the Lord, his God, as his father David's heart had been. Now, I want to stop there and point out a handful of things. First is something that is kind of obvious. If there's anything that will turn a person's heart away from the Lord quicker than anything else, it's a relationship. It's one of the things that has gotten Terry and I into trouble more times than not when we've tried to counsel younger people, because they get all kinds of upset and they don't want to listen to you anymore. When we try to tell them, hey, you don't want to marry that person. You need to give it some time. Either that person's not born again, I'm telling you, it's not going to end well. You're going to have more trouble than it's worth. I'm telling you, that person might know the Lord, but they're not as dedicated to the Lord as you are. And before long, your heart's going to become less and less devoted to him over time. And it'd be amazed. You would be amazed. And you might be able to pay attention to this in your own life. How often, Terry and I have noticed over the years, all it takes is for a young person to start getting caught on fire to the Lord, and all of the sudden, out of the middle of nowhere, here comes this guy or this girl that they get all caught up in. And I'm like, gee, that was convenient, wasn't it? And they're like, they love the Lord, and they're all like this, and they're all like that. And I already know, inside of 6 months to 9 months, we're going to have someone crying on our shoulder, or we're going to be hearing about a pregnancy, or we're going to be hearing about some other problem, because this, you know, the timing was too convenient. It was pretty obvious this was a setup, and we tried to warn them. And I have yet to have a young person listen to me when it came to do with that, because they're so in love. It's just so dangerous. If there's anything the enemy's going to use to manipulate you and to derail you, it will be a relationship. So just keep your eyes open and don't be stupid. You know, especially with convenient stuff, when something just pops out of the middle. Some of these kids hadn't had a date in their whole life, and they start getting dedicated to God, and all of a sudden they have three or four people wanting to date them. I'm like, okay, I'm not calling you stupid. I'm just saying, can you not see a pattern here? You know, come on, really? You know, the only thing that has changed here is you got devoted to God. You're not a different person, all of a sudden, there's a ton of suitors. So let's think through this. This is a tactic of the enemy to draw us away. They don't have to be terrible people. They could even be other Christians. They can just be less dedicated to Christ than you are. And that has an eroding effect on your relationship, a diluting effect on your devotion. It's very dangerous. So, and Solomon, in all of his wisdom, there wasn't enough wisdom in the world to keep him from falling to the historical thing that every human being seems to fall into. So this was a dangerous problem. And I want you to also notice, though, that God notices, and there is such a thing. And I don't say this, I kind of say it with a little bit of fear and trembling, because I don't want to elicit inside of the heart an excuse. because there isn't one. But God notices and knows the difference between a person that turns their heart completely against him and a person who has a divided loyalty to him. And he doesn't judge them as being completely identical, at least not entirely. I mean, the scriptures are very clear, you know, when it says that, you know, if you break the law, even at one point, you're guilty of all of it. So there's that side. Not having a heart that's completely devoted to God is just as bad as having one that isn't devoted to him at all. That is a truth. But there's also the consideration that God recognizes that, you know, a person can become less dedicated. Not as dedicated as they were, but they haven't turned completely away. And that's a dangerous place to be. That is not a place any Christian should ever stay. Because we already know God's feeling about it. And that is, you know what? I want to throw you up out of my mouth. You're lukewarm. You make me want to vomit. But, you know, God isn't moved by his emotions. He wants to. And I'm not saying that it cannot come to that. But he does not immediately react that way. And we all can say thank you, God, for that, because we've all been the lukewarm person at one point in our Christian faith. I'm certain. At least I have. So, but I just wanted to point that out. Verse 4, when Solomon was old, his wives seduced him to following other gods. His heart was not completely with the Lord. Hear the wording? Which is to say, it wasn't completely against the Lord. It was kind of riding the fence, right? And as his father David's heart had been. And I just think it's worthy of noting that our God is gracious enough to note the difference. I'm grateful. I don't ever want him to have to note that difference in my life. Again, he should never have to share loyalties with any of our hearts with anything else but himself. He's deserving of all of it. But I'm grateful that he's gracious. So moving on to verse 5, it says, Solomon followed Ashtoreth and the goddess of the Sidonites and Milcom and the detestable idol of the Ammonites. Solomon did what was evil in the Lord's sight, and unlike his father, David, he did not completely follow the Lord. At that time, Solomon built a high place for Shamash, the detestable idol of Moab, and for Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites on the hill across from Jerusalem. He did the same for all his foreign wives. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of idols. He had a lot of them, right? Who were burning incense and offering sacrifices to their gods. The Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Now, that's another big issue. God wasn't just angry at the sin. That's enough. That'd be enough to get God angry. But God was particularly angry with Solomon because this isn't just someone who knew about God. This is someone who had met him. This is a man who'd had an encounter with God. This is very much like, don't many of you seek to be teachers because they receive a stricter judgment? Because to whom much is given, much is required, right? I mean, those were two different verses, but you know what I mean. Solomon was brought into a position of power, had been raised by a father who worshiped God, and God was not just the God of his father. God appeared to him two times. And even after all of that, his heart was able to be turned away just because he liked women. It was a very, very terrible thing. Because it'd be one thing if he had not known God on that level. But to know God on that level and deliberately choose something else makes it a deeper sin. Verse 10, God had commanded him about this so that he would not follow after other gods. But Solomon did not do what the Lord had commanded. Then the Lord said to Solomon, since you have done this and did not keep my covenant and my statutes, which I commanded you, I will tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. However, I will not do it during your lifetime because of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the entire kingdom away even from him. I will give one tribe to your son because of my servant David and because of Jerusalem that I chose. Now, I want you to hear that as well. Solomon is receiving honor and privilege because of who was his dad. Not just because it was David, but because David was the guy he was. David was a man who worshiped the Lord and loved him, and God honored David. Now, David's already gone on. He's on the other side. David is looking with clearer eyes than he's ever looked. He's not looking so much at Solomon as his son, as just another Israelite. He was his son according to the flesh. But, you know, now, today, Solomon in heaven with his father David, I doubt very seriously they call each other father and son. They're just David and Solomon. Those were designations they left behind in this life. That relationship is many times older to them than the relationship that they know and enjoy now. But even though that's true, God still honored his covenant and honored the man who was his friend, David. And not only by not ripping the kingdom away from his son Solomon during his life, which Solomon did not earn, but also by being kind to David's grandson and at least allowing him to remain a king of a single tribe. So this is just God's faithfulness. God didn't owe this to anybody. I mean, if you remember, the terms of this with David was, if your descendants will walk in my ways and do my commandments and my statutes and my precepts, I will make sure that one of your descendants stays on the throne of Israel forever. But if they depart from my ways, I will take it away from them. So God was fully in his rights to just take the whole thing away. But you see, the heart of God, he had the legal right to do it, but he didn't have the heart to do it, because that's the God we serve. So, you know, we worship an amazing God who is easily moved and loves us. So let's move on to verse 14. It says, so the Lord raised up Hadad, the Edomite, as an enemy against Solomon. He was of the royal family of Edom. Earlier, when David was in Edom, Joab, you remember, the commander of the army, had gone to bury the dead and had struck down every male in Edom. For Joab and all Israel had remained there 6 months until he had killed every last male in Edom. Hadad had fled to Egypt along with some Edomites from his father's servants. At the time, Hadad was a small boy. Hadad and his men set out from Midian and went to Paran. They took men with them from Paran and went to Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave Hadad a house and ordered that he be given food, and he gave him land. Pharaoh liked Hadad so much that he gave him a wife, the sister of his own wife, Queen Tophanes. Tophanes' sister gave birth to Hadad's son, Genubath. Tophanes herself weaned him in Pharaoh's palace, and Genubath lived there along with Pharaoh's sons. When Hadad heard in Egypt that David rested with his fathers and that Joab, the commander of the armies, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, let me leave so that I can go back to my own country. But Pharaoh asked him, what do you lack here with me for you want to go back to your own country? Nothing, he replied, but please let me leave even still. So God raised up Rezin, son of Eliada, as an enemy against Solomon. Rezin had fled from his master Hadadezer, king of Zobah, and gathered men to himself. He became captain of a raiding party when David killed the Zobahites. He went to Damascus, lived there, and became king in Damascus. Rezin was Israel's enemy throughout Solomon's reign, adding to the trouble Hadad had caused. He ruled over Aram, but he loathed Israel. Now, I want you to notice, all of this was God's doing. God rose these enemies up against Solomon during his reign. Because remember, back when Solomon was doing everything he was supposed to do and honoring God, he had peace. But when he decided to not honor God and start worshiping other gods, God not only said, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you, but you won't see it in your lifetime. I'm taking it away from your son. But also, what Solomon was going to experience in his life was a lack of peace, which was fitting to having broken koinonia with God is to have a lack of peace. You would almost expect that, wouldn't you? Though this was on a national level. And so it also shows God's control and God's power, because none of these situations would have happened if God had not, in his sovereignty, said, you know what? You and you, I want you guys to now be Solomon's enemy. Go at it. And they did it. It was by, you know, God rules supreme in the affairs of man. We might think that we are doing this of our own free will, but I got news for you. God can get the outcome he's looking for. Verse 26, it says, now Solomon's servant Jeroboam, son of Nebat, was an Ephraimite from Zeredah. His widowed mother's name was Zeruah. Jeroboam rebelled against Solomon, and this is the reason he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the supporting terraces and repaired the opening in the wall of the city of his father David. Now, it's not told us as to why that was a problem, but evidently this was something that was a problem for Jeroboam. Now, the man Jeroboam was capable, and Solomon noticed the young man because he was getting things done. So he appointed him over the entire labor force of the house of Joseph. During that time, the prophet Ahijah, the Silonite, met Jeroboam on the road as Jeroboam came out of Jerusalem. And Ahijah had wrapped himself with a new cloak, and the two of them were alone in the open field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he had on, tore it into 12 pieces, and said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord God of Israel says. I'm about to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I will give you 10 tribes, but one tribe will remain his because of my servant David and because of Jerusalem, the city I chose out of all the tribes of Israel. For they have abandoned me. They have bowed the knee to Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonites, to Shemoth, the god of Moab, and to Milcom, the god of the Ammonites. They have not walked in my ways to do what is right in my eyes and to carry out my statutes and my judgments as their father David did. However, I will not take the whole kingdom from his hand, but will let him be ruler all the days of his life because of my servant David, whom I chose and whom kept my commandments and my statutes. I will take 10 tribes of the kingdom from his son, hand them son's hand, and give them to you. I will give one tribe to his son so that my servant David will always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem. The cities I chose for myself to put my name there, I will appoint you, and you will reign as king over all you want, and you will be king over Israel. After that, if you obey all I command you, walk in my ways and do what is right in my sight in order that I might, in order to keep my statutes and my commandments as my servant David did, I will be with you. I will build you a lasting dynasty, just as I built for David, and I will give you Israel. I will humble David's descendants because of their unfaithfulness, but not forever. Therefore, Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but he fled to Egypt, to Shishak, king of Egypt, where he remained until Solomon's death. Now we're going to read the two last portions, which cover Solomon's actual death. And that's, we're just going to continue on to verse 41 through 43 and then read 2 Chronicles 9 about that. Verse 41 in the same passage says, the rest of the events of Solomon's reign, along with all his accomplishments and his wisdom, are written about in the book of Solomon's events. The length of Solomon's reign in Israel over all of Israel totaled 40 years. Solomon rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of his father David. His son Rehoboam became king in his place. Now, 2 Chronicles 9, verse 29 through 31, just a few verses. Chapter 9, verse 29 through 31 in 2 Chronicles gives us the same account. It says, the remaining events of Solomon's reign from the beginning to end are written about in the events of Nathan the prophet of Ahijah, the Shilonite, and the visions of Iddo, the seer, concerning Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel for 40 years. Solomon rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of his father David. His son Rehoboam became king in his place. Now, A couple of things I want to say in wrapping things up before I open it up to anyone who might have a question or a statement is I want to read a handful of passages that address, I already talked to you a little bit about the diluting effect that relationships, the wrong kind of relationships, can have on your devotion to God. But, those were the only things that were brought up. If you remember, the two things that seem to preempt, if you will, Solomon's departure and allegiance to God was those women and his wealth, both of them. And the scripture has much to say about the effects that wealth can have on the human heart. And most of them aren't good. The first one I'm going to read you is in Psalm 52, starting in verse 1. It says, and this is an account, this is written by David, when Doeg, the Edomite, went and reported to Saul, telling him that David had gone to Ahimelech's house. You may remember that. That was just not that long ago. We just read that. And this is when the psalm was written. It says, "Why brag about evil, you hero? God's faithful love is constant. Like a sharpened razor, your tongue devises destruction, working treachery. You love evil instead of good, lying instead of speaking truthfully." Think about this. "You love any words that destroy, you treacherous tongue. This is why God will bring you down forever. He will take you, ripping you out of your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living." Think about that. "The righteous will look on with awe and will ridicule him. They will say, 'Here is the man who would not make God his refuge, but trusted in the abundance of his riches, taking refuge in his destructive behavior.'" There's some ways that could be said of Solomon. He took refuge in his destructive behavior and in his riches rather than in God. "But I am like a flourishing olive tree in the house of God. I trust in God's faithful love forever and ever. I will praise you forever for what you have done. In the presence of your faithful people, I will put my hope in your name because it is good." We look now at Proverbs chapter 11. Proverbs chapter 11, looking at verse 27 through 31. 27 through 31 in Proverbs 11. It says, "The one who searches for what is good finds favor. But if someone looks for trouble, it will come to him. Anyone trusting in his riches will fall." It's not an if, it's a certainty. "But the righteous will flourish like foliage. The one who brings ruin on his household will inherit the wind, and a fool will be a slave to someone whose heart is wise. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, but violence takes lives. If the righteous will be repaid on earth, how much more the wicked and the sinful?" I want you to notice so far in these verses, and I'm not saying this is a hardcore rule because we know it's not, but God seems to make a difference between the righteous and the rich, as if he's saying, as a general note, the righteous usually aren't rich. I'll just leave that right there. You can do your own study, but I think you'll find the same pattern throughout Scripture. It's not a hard and fast rule. We know that because David was wealthy and he was righteous. We know that Solomon, for the first part of his life, was wealthy and righteous. So it's not a hard and fast rule, but it's more true than not. Just saying. Luke 18:4 says, "As for the seed that fell among thorns," Jesus talking about the seed and the sower, "these are the ones who, when they have heard, go on their way and are choked with worries, riches, and the pleasures of life. And the seed winds up bringing no fruit to maturity." Riches are part of that equation. It doesn't have to be, but a lot of times it is. And you remember Jesus also says, you cannot serve both God and material wealth. You got to choose one. James chapter 2, reading the first 10 verses in chapter 2, says, "My brothers, hold your faith and our glorious Lord Jesus Christ without showing favoritism. For suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring, dressed in fine clothes, and a poor man dressed in dirty clothes also comes in. If you look with favor on the man wearing the fine clothes so that you say, oh, sit here in a good place, and yet say to the poor man, stand over there, or sit here on the floor by my footstool, haven't you shown discrimination against among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my dear brothers, didn't God choose the poor in this world to be rich in faith and heirs of his kingdom? That's maybe the reason for the former statement of making a declaration between the rich and the righteous. He says, listen, my dear brothers, didn't God choose the poor in this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom that he has promised to those who love him? Yet you dishonored that poor man. Don't the rich oppress you and drag you into the courts? Don't they blaspheme that noble name by which you are called, that you bear? If you really carry out the royal law prescribed in Scripture, that you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. But if you show favoritism, then you commit sin or are convicted by the law as a transgressor. For whoever keeps the entire law and yet fails even in one point is guilty of breaking it all. But I want you to notice some key things there is that he, again, makes a distinction between those people who are poor in this world. He says these are the ones that God has chosen to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom. And isn't it the rich who do the oppressing and drag you into courts? And isn't by and large, it's rich people who blaspheme the name of the Lord? Now, again, James wasn't saying this is always the truth and it's never not true. He's just saying it's more true than not. In fact, it's so true most of the time that you could pretty much set it up as a general rule. The last passage I wanted to read to you, or last two passages, is James chapter 5, verses 1 through 8. He says, come now, you rich people, weep and wail over the miseries that are coming on you. Your wealth is ruined. Your clothes are moth-eaten. Your silver and your gold are corroded. And their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You stored up treasure in the last days. Look, the pay that you withheld from the worker who reaped your field cries out, and the outcries of the harvesters has reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived luxuriously in the land and have indulged yourself. You have fattened your hearts for the day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the righteous man. He doesn't even resist you. Therefore, brothers, be patient until the Lord's coming. By the way, this might be very appropriate for our day. Therefore, brothers, be patient until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth and is patient with it until it receives the early and the latter rains. You must also be patient. Strengthen your hearts because the Lord's coming is very near. And the last passage I wanted to read to you is in Psalm 62, verse 8 through 12. It says, trust in the Lord at all times, you people. Pour out your hearts before him. God is a refuge. Men are only a vapor, exalted men, an illusion. On a balance scale, they go up. Together, they weigh less than a vapor. Place no trust in oppression or false hope in robbery. If wealth increases, pay no attention to it. God has spoken once. I've heard this twice, that strength belongs to God, and faithful love belongs to you, Lord, for you repay to each one according to his works. So, you know, and these are just, it didn't take me very long. In fact, I just before we got on tonight, I quickly did a search and found just these five or six verses. If you wanted to do a comprehensive look on riches and wealth and on unrighteousness being attached to them, you would probably walk away with a small book. The Bible has much to say about it. As you know, God does not in any way demonize riches. They in themselves are not the problem. But it's very hard for man to have riches and not set his heart on them. and to not place his trust in them rather than God. If a person has great wealth, they feel very little need for, you know, trust in God. What do I need to trust him for? I've got money. I mean, I can pay for any lawyer I needed. I could pay for any doctor I needed. I could buy any house I wanted. I don't need to trust God. I mean, I like him. I might love him. I might call Jesus Lord, but I don't really need him to come and save me because I've got millions of dollars. I don't need his help. It's a dangerous place to be in, which is why that last passage said, you know what, if wealth and riches increase, do not pay any attention to it. Ignore it. Don't get caught up in it. Okay? All right, well then we'll go ahead and close with prayer.
Grace. 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 Grace.